Center, Deconstructing the World of Self. I think, as you've learned, that is a lifetime endeavor. But through the practice of mindfulness and concentration and insight, over these past 4 days, for some it was a beginning, for many a continuation of doing this most essential work. I would say the work that truly separates Buddhism from many other isms. As I said at other times, the practices of mindfulness and the practices of concentration are not particular to Buddhism, even though Buddhism has given it its own caste or way of doing it. But those practices are known in many other traditions and practiced in many other traditions and non-traditions. There are many things, just ordinary things in life, martial arts or things like that, where mindfulness and concentration, other types of activities are well known. But the unique thing about the Buddhist path is its path of insight. That it formulates a very clear, understandable concept of why people suffer. And therefore, how to free oneself from suffering. And it is taught that we need to clearly understand the cause of our suffering, right? Second noble truth. And the cause of our suffering is ego delusion. I mean, it's a little bigger than that. We see all forms as having a permanent, substantial quality to it. All forms. We do not see the interdependence of every phenomena in the world. But that kind of generic view of reality does not speak with direct poignancy to the human condition. How that shows up for each one of us is self. Right? That is the permanent solid entity that we are most identified with, and therefore it is our biggest delusion and most significant delusion. Right? I mean, one may not understand that the tree has no separate existence from the earth, and the earth has no from the dirt, and the dirt has no separate from the earth, and the earth has no separate. You know what I mean? We can go through all that, and the clouds and the rain, and that's it's kind of sweet knowing that, but it doesn't liberate you from your suffering. So that is why in Buddhism we talk about the twofold emptiness. The emptiness of things and the emptiness of self. Now, as many of you have known, that you could endlessly read and talk about the tree and the paper and and the tree and the clouds and the water and the earth and the you know what I mean, that one, right? And that is a conceptual understanding of how things are in the world, right? See, that can only be really understood through analysis. But the wonderful thing is the emptiness of self, the non-self nature of self, can be directly experienced because it is the very nature of our own minds. So it doesn't have to be a conceptual experience. It can be a living, breathing experience. Therefore, it is called enlightenment. It's a personally transformative experience. Having an intellectual scientific, whatever you want to call it, philosophical understanding of the interdependence of everything is not liberative. Right? You're the same jerk you were, except you got some interesting ideas. Right? But insight into the true nature of self is liberative. Is that clear? You see that that jerk has no substance to it. It's just made up of parts that were put together sort of, you know, according to causes and conditions that somehow I took as myself. And all these thoughts and all these ideas, you know, that I so identify with are nothing, no thing. And the self that so identifies with my ideas and my beliefs and my, you know, my past and my future and my reputation, and, you know, all that stuff doesn't exist in any inherent way. It's just imaginative. But because we are deluded, right? We think that that which is imaginative is real, right? Now, we accept magical thinking in children, right? We even find it entertaining. We accept magical thinking in literature, right? But we know it's a work of fiction. But this work of fiction that we have constructed in our imagination, we believe is real and true. And therefore, we spend incessant amount of time advancing and defending it. That is our major preoccupation in life. Right? We pretend we are, you know, we're going to work and we're carrying on this and we're volunteering here and we're having relations here. But no, that's not what we're doing. Right? We are meeting the needs of self. And we are projecting self onto everything we do. Sounds strong? Study Buddhism. You will see. I'm not saying anything that the Buddha didn't say. But these are harsh words. We don't like it, do we? Oof. Can't you sugarcoat that a little, friend? It is unfortunately the truth. And harsh words need to be spoken because for many of us, we don't hear it otherwise. We listen with half our attention. We hear the words, but we don't hear the meaning or the significance. The Buddha's teachings on non-self, on the empty nature of all phenomena, is the most profound message the Buddha spoke. And it came out of not philosophical inquiry, it came out of meditative inquiry into the nature of his own mind. So that should give everybody hope, because all of us have a mind, right? And there is no evidence that the Buddha ever went, you know, to university. He never had a degree, you know, right? We don't know his reading capacity. So, you know, there are people who spend a lot of time in their life, you know, kind of feeling so somehow deep down inside they're unworthy or they're stupid and not that smart and they have to project an image and that's the worst thing they, you know, they don't want to be found out about, right? Well, again, the Buddha, there's no evidence that he even went to school. And yet, he was able to discover the most profound truths of the human situation. That should give us all hope. Right? We know among his followers, he had mass murderers, he had totally uneducated, the lowest of the low in Hindu society, untouchables and street, cleaners, became his disciples and had stream entering awakenings. That should give us hope, right? For anybody here who thinks, well, I just don't have the capacity. We all have the capacity. We just don't have the will. We don't have the diligence, the vigilance. We don't have all those qualities. We don't have the aspiration. We don't have the attention. I mean, we should be honest with ourselves. It's not that we don't have the capacity. Everyone here has the capacity. So you only have to look into your own mind. It's readily apparent if you spend some time looking into your own mind that there is no self, right? Is that true, Bill? I mean, yeah, even Bill just kind of stumbled in here off the block. Right? He's kind of wandered in, looks into his mind and goes, there's nothing there. Right? You don't have a PhD in Buddhist studies, do you, Bill? Or have you been fooling me all those years? No, not a clue. And yet, it's readily apparent. Again, there are depths of the experience. There are depths of the understanding. Seeing it once is not enough. You have to see it 10,000 times. Because we have upheld the tyranny of self 10 million times. It is deeply ingrained. So it is this constant willing to subject the self to analysis, the mind to analysis, to deep looking, over and over and over. And over time, what began as just an intellectual insight or meditative insight begins to permeate one's life. Right? One begins to see things differently. One begins to feel more connected, less separate. Because that which is separating us is beginning to diminish. Right? We're forgetting, you see. Dogen says, right? Study of Buddhism is a study of self. To study the self is to forget the self. You know, it's beginning to show up in life and realize, see, I don't have any self-concern. I'm just present. I forgot myself. Don't panic. It's a good feeling. Right? You may notice in your relationships, in your life, you know, you're forgetting the self. It's no longer at the center of your experience. I mean, any questions before we talk about future practice, which is really sort of the focus of this talk this morning? Any questions in terms of the teachings and the practices that we have done in terms of just understanding? Yes, Libby.
You just mentioned 10,000 in that verse by Dogen.
Mm-hmm.
But I memorized answer, to forget the self is to be enlightened by 10,000.
Thanks. Well, we'll talk about that. So that the question is, and that, there's actually another verse after that, the line after that, about dropping body and mind. But, you know, enough is enough for 1 4-day retreat. So we'll talk in a minute about how to be enlightened by the 10,000 things, which has, again, multiple meanings. Anything left over, unresolved, from what we've done in the last 3 days. Please don't be shy. This is an opportunity. Anything not clear, anything murky, anything sticking, you know, anything. Oh, what was that about? Yes, Lani.
So I guess
I'm
starting to grasp.
Yeah, this is. Good. You're getting our lingo. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was your experience when you. Yes. Yes. Yeah, no, but you're right. No, you're right on target. Again, so the first question was kind of doing this kind of where you're kind of watching yourself or observing yourself, sort of like you're outside of self. Lanny said, it feels weird, right? Yeah, a little disorienting. Yeah, it is. Because we are so used to, you know, being in ourself, just kind of being ourself. And the idea that somehow we can step back and observe, right? It's sort of like, you know, if you had grown up in some kind of culture that didn't have mirrors, you know, so you never really knew what you looked like. You can imagine the first time you looked in the mirror and you saw that was you, it could be a little weird, you know, if you could imagine it. Like what? You know, because you never had an idea what you looked like. So it's sort of like that, you see. And the reason we do that is, you know, like the same reason we look in the mirror. We can see how it looks and we can make adjustments. We can see our mind and see ourselves and see what we're doing and begin to go, you know, to see what we're doing, to see what our thoughts are, what's underneath it, and to see again, after you've learned in this retreat, the role of self. How often that's the prime mover when you are agitated, when you are upset, you know. I mean, why are you upset? Because self, as we said, doesn't like what's going on. Self is always in combat with things as they are. And so without that self-awareness, you know, what you're saying, you can't see it. So it's, yeah, it's a continuation of practice, but it's really even more this willingness over and over again to see the imprint of self. You know, you kind of know who the culprit is. You know, it's like, again, you're always wondering, you know, why is there always food missing, you know, in the kitchen? And one day you see little tracks and you're, oh, now I know, you know, I know who it is. You see, you didn't know before. See, now, whenever we have any kind of emotional fixation or act out or self-consciousness, self is present. You know, we know. And we notice that when we're very self-conscious or when we're emotionally vexated, as you say, we're suffering. I mean, it's not a comfortable, easy feeling. And so again, these practices are part of the path. What is the path? I want to be happy. I want to be free. I want to be at ease. You know what I mean? So it's in the service of that. But again, we are so embedded with this other way of living, you know, like, you know, that it's, you know, even if we have an insight, you know, you know, don't be surprised if 5 minutes later you're doing the same thing all over again. You know, that's just because, as we said, in our storehouse consciousness, it's, you know, it's all still there. So even though the insights may come, right, the transformation takes time. Does that? Yeah. Because, you know, you're what? Yeah. And all of a sudden, you're kind of telling the boss who's been running the show, I'm not sure if I really want to listen to you anymore. You know, so don't be surprised if you get pushback. All right? You know, I mean, like you know, ego self has been running the show. Do this, don't do that. Get upset, get angry, get scared, get, you know what I mean? And we do it. Yes, sir. Right? You see, and all of a sudden you're going, maybe I don't have to. You see? You know, maybe there's another way of responding. So don't, you know, the fact that, you know, you feel this kind of uncomfortableness and this, I mean, you know, that's why it's very important that you kind of, you know, that we have these kinds of instructions so we're kind of clear what we're doing. We're not just kind of following directions. You know, I mean, like you understand what this process is about. So you know, it makes sense to you. You know what you're doing. You're not just doing a practice, you know, because everybody told you to do it. You know, we want to spend time to make sure that we really are clear about what we're doing and why we're doing it. Okay? Thank you. Any other questions? Yes. Paul.
I'm struggling with the idea that you could say controlled by self.
Mm-hmm.
And then turn around and say there's no self.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, yeah, how can you say that? I mean, have you ever been to a movie? Have you, so he's the question is about, have you ever been to a movie? When you go to the movie, do you get involved in it? I mean, you know, if it's an action movie, you're excited. If it's a sad movie, you get sad. If it's a comedy, you laugh, right? Right? You do. You know that experience. Are movies real? No. Did you dream last night? You might have dreamt. You just don't remember you dreamt. All right. But have you, or let me clarify that. Have you ever had a dream? All right. In the dream, when you were in the dream, did it seem real? Did you have emotions? Were things going on? You know, lots of, you know, all kinds of happy dreams, sad dreams, action dreams, you know, right? And yet, Paul, are dreams real? Yeah, you've been sitting too close to Alex. Why is it so hard to get a simple answer out of your guy? Paul, are dreams real? That's a yes or no question. I mean, are they really valid things? I mean, you know, are they real? I mean, I realize they had a temporary reality when you were in the dream, but when you wake up from the dream, what do you know about the dream? What, you know, was it real? Paul? No. I want you to say what your experience. Paul, are dreams real? Do they have an inherent reality? Or when you wake up from the dream, you realize it was just a dream. You know, let's say you dreamt that you inherited $10 million in the dream. You won the lottery, right? And in the dream, they gave you the money and you had this great life that you were living now, right? Okay? Then you wake up. What do you realize about the dream? Because why? Because it wasn't real. And not only was the dream not real, you, the guy who was so happy in the dream but he had the money, weren't real either. It was all made up. By who? By you. Okay? And yet you were a full participant in it. It had a temporary reality when you were in the dream. Right? But when you woke up, you saw it was total fiction. We are now in the dream of the solid self. It seems very real. Right? And therefore, all our actions are based on it. Right? Okay. What we're trying to do is wake up and see there's nothing inherently there. That is why this investigatory process, which we just kind of, you know, just began, will show you clearly that that self, you know, it feels like there's a self here, doesn't it? You know, it feels like Paul's over there and these are Paul's ideas and this is Paul's body and this is Paul's life. I understand that, you see. In Buddhism, we have something called, we accept that things appear a certain way. But just because they appear that way, but not be the way they really are. For example, the example of a rainbow. You see a rainbow. Does it look like a real thing? Yeah. It appears that way, doesn't it? But if you get in your car and start trying to find the rainbow, will you find one? Why not, Paul? Because even though it appears as a solid, self-existent thing, it is not. Just causes and conditions, you know, water and, you know, light have come together, you know, in a, for a brief moment in time to create the illusion. In this way, many things, physical and mental, have come together to produce something called that, that, which your parents called Paul. But you're no different than the rainbow. Good. Yeah, it's... To understand that is called liberation, freedom. Yeah, it's much lighter than, you know, having this permanent self that we have to lug around. Right? Carry it around all day, put it down at night, wake up in the morning, pick up the self, lug it around all day. You know, it's like, yeah, wouldn't it be better to just kind of get up in the morning and just go about your business? No, you're right. Any other questions? Yeah, so what does life look like? See, if study of Buddhism is a study of self, the study of self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by the 10,000 things. 10,000 things, of course, stand for everything. So, if we are no longer self-centered, right? If we are no longer selfish, if we are no longer egocentric, if we are no longer lost in the dream of self, and we come out of it, what do we notice? And we notice spaciousness, but all of a sudden we notice what? The world. There's a world out there. Yeah. And especially if the filters of self are no longer endlessly projecting and we're seeing things as they are. It's a very different way of living. Now we're not, now at this point, everything we experience is self-referential. Everything that happens refers to me. But what if that no longer is the way you operate? And you are present without any filters to everything and everyone. Now, true interconnection, connection, becomes possible. Now, true love becomes possible. True compassion becomes possible. True generosity becomes possible. Because that which has kept us separate, always peering out to life through this little, you know, like we're in prison, you know, we got that little peephole and we look out onto life. Right? You know, what should I do now? And always checking with oneself. Right? How do I want to deal with this? And how do I want to relate to this? And how do I want to feel about this? And how do I want to respond? You know what I mean? Every, you know, self, it just is always picking and choosing and manipulating and quantifying. Right? You know how it's so narrow, it's so tight, it's so petty, it's so constricted, the world of self. What if that's gone? And things are very open and spacious, and you're connected to everyone. in everything. Right? You know, there are some people, you know, every time you ask them to do anything, their first response is either no or let me think about it. Saying a spontaneous yes is incredibly difficult. Why is that? That's what it's like. Buddhas say yes. You know, how did the Buddha live? He'd come to a town, he'd sit down. Right? Anybody who came, he taught. Right? Once a day they go into town. See if somebody give him some food. Right? I mean, it's total ease, total openness. Practice saying yes. We're very good at saying no. Now, I know there are some people here who are probably going immediately, ooh, sounds like codependence. You know, some people are going, hold on a second. I always used to say yes, and I've just been learning now how to say no. Is Fred going? Just say, you know. But you see, that yes and no is the yes and no because we're not healthy, right? Because we've always said yes for unhealthy reasons. Is that clear? What kind of reasons? Reasons of ego. Reasons of self. I want people to love me. I want people to like me. I don't, you know what I mean? Can you see, it's all manipulative. We think we got to say yes or no to get something. That's ego. Ego always wants something. It bargains, right? Let me see, if I say yes, 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 and I do this, even though I really don't want to, then they'll like me. They'll love me. They'll think I'm a good person. Or at the very least, they won't be angry. God. One thing my ego does not like is people to be angry at me. You know, can you see what I'm saying? All that is the world of self. Right? It's no different than the superior self. It's just another form of self. That's why the verse says, liberate me from the superiority, the inferiority, the equality. They're all the same. They're all different stances because of causes and condition the self takes in life. Okay. You know. What is it, you know, in our path, we would say, well, what's the opposite of the narcissist? What's the opposite of living an egocentric, self-centered life? Well, we have the ideal of the bodhisattva. Right? The awakened being who lives for others. Over here is you and I. We live for who? Ourselves. And maybe a few others that we claim as ours. My family, my friend. You know, I'll include you because you're part of mine. You see? Then there's everybody else. Bodhisattvas embrace everyone. They live for everyone. They want to take care of everyone. They're concerned about everyone. Now again, those are extremes, right? Here, total self-centeredness, total self-concern. Here, total openness. Here, total other concern. But if you ask what the continuum looks like, there's the continuum. You know, there's the movement of our life. We move from self-centeredness to other-centeredness. From self-concern to other concern. I mean, what if we woke up in the morning and rather than thinking about ourselves, we thought about, who can I benefit today? How can I be of benefit to everyone I encounter today? Not how can I get my needs met today? How can I accomplish my to-do list today? How can I get all my projects done today? You know what I mean? It's like, not that those things don't need to be taken care of, but it's like, what's in the mind? How can I be of benefit to people today? How can I help people today? How can I bring value to every encounter I have with human beings? How can I make sure that everything I say today to anyone is right speech? You know, I'm not just speaking to hear myself speak. I'm not just telling everybody, you know, a lot of people, when they talk, all they talk about is who? Themselves. Let me tell you what I've been doing. Right? You know, again, I understand in relationships we talk, but I'm talking about that's the first place we go. Let me tell you about me, what I've been doing. Right? Rather than what? Hi, Betsy, what have you been doing? Tell me about you. I'm interested in you, you see? Because if you don't have a strong self, there is no self here that you're referring to. You just see who? Betsy. See, Betsy's your world. Libby's your world. So your natural concern is the world, you know, that you're encountering. But if you're still self-concerned, and if you're dragging self into this incident, you know, it's all about how can I, you know, impress Betsy? You know, I've done so many good things lately. I want to tell her all about it. Right? Why? Because it's so important to me. Right? Isn't that true? Let me tell you what I've been up to. You know, why don't we wait till somebody asks us? Let me try that for a change. You know, at least you'd know they're interested. But most of us, we don't give anybody else a chance. Right? Watch our language. Is it all about I, me, my? Or is it about you? How can I make you happy today? Hmm? We're in a relationship with somebody. Hmm? What are we watching? What they're doing to make us happy or not? It never dawned on us, maybe it should be about what can I do for this other person today to make them happy, to support them in their life. Right? Now again, that often begins like a stance, you know what I mean? Let's go, well, yeah, I'm going to try that. See, it begins like, and it really is just another ego strategy, but it's coming from a good place. You know, this is a developmental model, right? You don't become a Buddha, Bodhisattva overnight, right? So we start with a selfish self. We eventually get to a place where, through a lot of good work, we now have a wholesome, selfless self, and then we get rid of the whole thing because we don't need it. I mean, do you need a self to brush your teeth? You know, drive a car? To carry on a conversation? You might think you do. But if you actually, unless you're really scripting every word you say and rehearsing every human encounter you have, most of the time we're just talking. You know, life doesn't have to be scripted. Again, the problem is at this point for us, if we go off script, we often say and do things quite unwholesome because we have so much of that unwholesomeness in us. But as we transform ourselves at the upper levels of the mind, and most importantly, transform ourselves at the base, so to speak, more and more our spontaneous actions will be good actions, healthy actions, wholesome ones. That is the process of transformation. This is This is what the Buddha offers. The Buddha offered a path to Buddhahood. For many of us, that sounds far, far away, doesn't it? Right? Huh? But it's really what it's all about. That's why Buddhas appear in this. We said it this morning, right? When we enumerated the bodhisattvas, who appears the enlightened one, who appears in the midst of suffering and confusion to show us the way. You know, why do Buddhas appear in this world system? Right? Please remember that the Buddha, after his great enlightenment, wasn't going to teach. Do you remember that? You know why he wasn't going to teach? Because he said to himself, these sentient beings, you know, they're not interested in this. They're too busy. This is 2,600 years ago. They're too busy. You know, their jobs and their work and raising their kids, you know, I mean, they're just too busy. That's what they're concerned about. You know, getting their boat all outfitted out for Gasparilla. I mean, you know, that's, you know, I mean, you know, those are the kind of things that people are concerned, you know, I mean, that's what they're busy doing. Who's going to be interested in the path to awakening? Who's going to be, you know, interested in the path out of suffering? He really went through this. And it wasn't through, according to the stories, from a series of incidents that people, that he was convinced that no, Buddha, there are some sentient beings where the dust of worldliness lies light on their eyes. Right? They're not heavily encrusted. And it was for them that the Buddha went forth. Now, the truth is, he didn't know who they were, did he? So he just wandered around northern India, seeing who he could pick up. And he picked up quite a number that had light dust on their eyes. They didn't, without all great effort, were able to see what he was offering and to kind of open their eyes. You know, and again, we have to decide, each of us, am I one of those? Am I one of those? Who, when I hear the Buddha's teachings, when I learn about the path of the Bodhisattva, when I learn about the potential that I have as a human being, we think this is something wonderful. This is something unique and special, worthy of my attention, worthy of my effort. Right? Or not. We're all different. And there are all degrees, you know, and speeds. And you know, the teachers say you can get to Miami by walking, you can get to Miami on a bike, you can get to Miami in a car, you can get to Miami, you know, by flying on a jet, right? They all take you to Miami, right? The question is, you know, how quickly do you want to get there? And that's really kind of what it's about in terms of how we go about practicing. And that's a, you know, personal decision. Some people might like to walk, take lots of detours. I wonder what's going on in Fort Myers, you know? They'll hang out there for a couple of decades, you know. Then move on down to Marco, you know. Just. You know, but some might want to go, no, I just want to go right to Miami. That's where I want to go. Is that clear? So it's, you know, there's personal choice here. The path is the same for everybody, but it's really what vehicle do you want to take? Again, I mean, I think part of the problem for people is the idea of living an enlightened life, being a bodhisattva, living a totally selfless life, you know, non-self, and is so foreign to us as Americans. You know, the path of enlightenment, this whole thing is just so far. We don't believe it. Because our path in America is is really, unfortunately, a path of self-improvement. See, that's the path we know. Right? Enunciated by that great teacher of self-improvement, George Bush, who said, what do you call it? Wouldn't it be nice if we could be a kindler, gentler? Isn't that what he said? A kindler, gentler. You know, that's like, you know, these great teachers of self-improvement. You know, I mean, that's what they've taught us. Yeah. Basically, you know, keep the same ego in control. Why don't we just make it a little kinder, a little nicer, right? That's kind of a model, right? It's a therapeutic model too. You know, I'll just learn how to cope a little better. You know, clean up my ego in its kind of worst deformations, function better. And again, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I'm not putting that down. But that's not what the Buddha taught. See, and there are many people teaching Buddhism as if it is just that, which is a disservice for Buddhism because there are already enough people teaching that in America. You know, you look at, every now and then I see these Buddhist magazines, I think, see, this is like Psychology Today. You know, it's like, it's kind of strange what's going on here. That's why it's important that we, read authentic teachings, read the teachings of the Buddhas, read the teachings of the great masters, so we can decide ourselves what Buddhism is about. You know, unfortunately, a lot of the books about Buddhism today are written by people, well, anyhow, they're good people, but they don't know much about Buddhism. Or again, they're filtering Buddhism through their own level of development and their own ideas. You know, it's more just self stuff. You know, Buddhism through my own constructs, rather than Buddhism as it was taught by the Buddha, taught by the great masters, who exist till today, fortunately. Any questions about what I've just been saying? Yes. Just slow down. So what does that mean when you say, just so I understand? So you say, I feel like there's a self listening to you.
Just like a rehearsal, like there'll be thoughts about things you say. You know, kind of resonating, like, you know, I might be reading some of those bad books or something.
Well, hold on, I'm not, yeah.
But when I look at this intention, like, really, am I really going to make this selfless jump into the realm of non-self?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's. I mean, that's right on. Yeah. So the question is, you know, Kelly's saying, you know, I listen, I have these thoughts, I want to jump in, but isn't this just more self? You know, isn't this just more self that wants to jump in or shouldn't jump in? And you know, isn't this all happening within the world of self? Even my desire to do this or not, and the answer is yes. Okay. It is only at a very high degree of development that we're really free of self. And we, again, as we learn in the Yogacara, at this stage, you know, this whole process that I described yesterday with the big storehouse consciousness and the manas and the self, you know, and that's conditioning, you know, our thinking mind, our discriminating. Yeah, I mean, that's the truth, okay? But it's not a thing, you see. It's many things. Right, and so within you, you have wholesome seeds and you have unwholesome seeds. You have clear thinking and you have confused thinking. Right, I mean, right, and you're going, well, how do I know which one this is? Right, well, that is why, you know, that great caveat in Buddhism, in relationship to our thoughts, you know, is it true? Right, I mean, is it true causes us to pause, you know, before we jump in, you know, and really spend some time, is this true? You know, it's sort of like I said to you yesterday in relationship, to the three refuges. I mean, Buddhism is very interesting. I mean, most religions that kind of present their three refuges or their credo, you know, it's like, buy into it. This is the truth. Buddhism says, no, check it out. You know, it's very interesting. It goes back to the Buddha himself. It's sort of like, oh, you know, Kelly goes, well, how do I know that, you know, my taking refuge is just another one of my unwholesome, you know? Well, check it out, you see? You know, run it through your discriminating mind, right? You know, does it make sense to you? Is it valid? You know, does it really corroborate with your experience? You see? So it doesn't say, you know, kind of, you know, well, you know, what's your gut feeling? Because, well, as you know, a lot of them our gut feeling gives us only bad advice. I mean, how many people have responded to something from their gut feeling and regretted it for years, right? So a lot of this stuff about, you know, sometimes our gut feeling can be correct, but I mean, we can't enshrine these things. So, so we want to pause, you know, especially for big decisions like, you know, direction for my life, right? You know, or taking refuge in a spiritual path. You know, these are things that we should reflect on, you know, and really make sure that there's clarity, right? So, yeah, I mean, I does that make sense to you? Yeah, because at this point, we have wholesome thoughts and we have unwholesome thoughts and we have healthy impulses and unhealthy impulses. And if we just kind of, you know, respond to the first one that pops up, yeah, well, you know what happens. I mean, it could work or it couldn't work. I mean, that's kind of the random. We want to stop living in that kind of random way. Right. Again, over time, you know, as the mind becomes more wholesome, as the thinking becomes clearer, you know, through the practice of mindfulness and concentration, as, you know, it becomes easier. We kind of know ourselves better. You know, we know what works. We know what's wholesome. We know how it feels. Right. So I'm sure there are areas in your life where you can say, yeah. Again, when I look back 20 years ago, yeah. There are areas of my life where I do approach it and make decisions very differently than I did back then. So you know that you're capable of that, right? But, you know, so you can just imagine, what if I extended that to all areas of my life and trusted myself that way, which you will, right? But it's a process. So you don't, knowing it's a process and knowing, you know, we are a process ourselves. So it's our, you know, it's our mindfulness and our willing to, what Lanny said, you know, to kind of step back and kind of look at this and, you know, where's this coming from? Is this coming from a healthy place in me? A comfortable place in, you know, or is it impulsive? Okay? So, you know, mindfulness, concentration, insight. Right? I mean, it, you know, it all circles back. Right? Right? You know, last night in our discussion, we were a little bit all over the place, right? And yet, this morning, right back. Right? Right back home. Back in the body, back in the breath, cultivating mindfulness and concentration, and beginning to peel back the layers of self, looking more deeply into it. Okay. I mean, that's the practice. And, you know, some of us, we are in a society that we are addicted to newness. Right? Do they still do classics like in college? Like classics course, you know? They still, that's all college? Well, that's good to know. Chris is, no? Not really. Some do and some don't, okay? Yeah. Yeah, everything's contemporary. Right? Yeah. So, I mean, that's kind of our culture. Everything's contemporary. Everything's changing, right? New look, new clothes, new food fads. I mean, it's all new, you know, everything is just changing, right? Everything is what's the best this year, right? I mean, that's so much in us, you know. So that's, I think, why, I mean, it's quite amazing, you know, with Buddhist books. There are always just new Buddhist books. It's like, I mean, have we really, you know, how about the ones that have been published the last 20 years? I mean, what's wrong with that? You see what I'm saying? But that's us, you know. And we have to be careful to know that's us. And I think we often bring that to our meditation, you know. The idea of just, you know, developing a craft, developing a skill, you know, like a musician or a craft or a skill or a profession. You know, it's a process, right, of learning, and it just takes time, right? This takes time, you know. That's the problem for a lot of Westerners. We're in a hurry. It doesn't work right away. Or, you know, again, we want to be successful. And, you know, it's like we practice with just being totally open and present in our meditation without any agenda. That's very hard for people because we always have an agenda, which is, I want to be successful here. Right? I want to do it right. I want to get an A. Right? And the truth is, in our meditation, most of us are getting a D-. C plus. Every now and then, we might, you know. Isn't that the truth? I mean, that's just the truth. But doesn't mean, you know, that over time, if we're persistent, we can't raise our grades. Okay? Be happy you're in the class. Be happy they let you in the class, even if you get... Even if you're getting a D-. Is that clear? So, you know, there's got to be aspiration and effort and diligence, but there has to be patience and understand. This self and this way we are and this out-of-control monkey mind we have cultivated, you know, well, at least if you're into this lifetime, for decades and decades. Now, luckily, Chris, you know, some of these younger people, you haven't done it as long. All right? So that's good, you see. You go, wow. I mean, look at all these old people around here. I mean, they've been cultivating this delusive, out-of-control mind, you know, for 60, 70 years. You guys have only been at it for 20 or so. Good. I mean, you know, I mean, that's in your favor, okay? But have compassion for the rest of us, okay? So, you know, again, we have to know ourselves. We have to begin where we're at, and we work where we're at, and we just work patiently and diligently with understanding, you know, acceptance. And transformation occurs. There has to be effort. I mean, you just can't sit down, you know, and go over what you're going to do today. You might as well not sit down and do that when you meditate. So there's got to be some awareness of what we're trying to cultivate here. And it takes time, you know. In Zen, when I used to practice, you know, pure Japanese Zen, I think they said it takes 5 years just to find your seat. You know, just to kind of feel, you know, to find that place of ease in sitting. 5 years sounds like a long time, doesn't it? But it really does. It takes time just to find that place where you're just at ease in sitting and you enjoy sitting. Takes time. So, any questions about how to proceed? We'll just talk about daily life. I mean, we're gonna do our closing circle soon. I mean, any questions that anybody has based on what's gone on retreat about how to proceed going back into your life? Everybody's going back into your life. You see, we've been together. Now we're all gonna separate. We're all gonna go to our own homes, our own lives, our own work, our own, you know. So we're going to kind of individuate very soon. And so if there's anything, specific challenges, or clear about how to proceed in your life, now's the time. Yes, Chris. Yeah, so you're kind of saying, I mean, you're saying two things. You're saying, isn't wanting liberation, isn't that just a self saying that? And then the other thing is, hey, but I thought we're already inherently liberated Buddhists, so isn't it just a matter kind of just being here and kind of uncovering? That's what you're saying. Okay. So from the point of view of isn't it the self, you know, that really wants liberation? And we would say yes, you see. But it's a wholesome aspiration. It's coming from a wholesome part of yourself. You know, you're not, that's what I meant, where you go kind of from a totally narcissistic, self-centered self to a selfless, altruistic self, and eventually, you know, it's all gone, okay? Is that clear? So it's a process. In Buddhism, we say the raft is not the shore. I don't know if you've ever heard that. That means, you know, if you're on this shore, if you're on this side of the river, to get across, you need a raft, okay? To get to the, you know, shore of awakening. Okay? But when you're there, you don't need to carry the raft with you. You don't need the raft anymore, okay? So, in a certain sense, this higher, you might say, higher transformed self will help us get there. Is that clear? But once we're there, it'll become more effortless. All right. Now, you know, you have to be very careful because you read these teachings such as, well, you know, we're all inherently Buddha, right? Or, you know, the Zen masters say, you know, what's the highest truth of Buddhism? And they say, what? In summer I sweat, in winter I freeze. And you go, gee, I'm already doing that. Well, this is easy. You know what I mean? I mean, there are actually a lot of people who come to Zen who kind of ask you, kind of think, oh, yeah, what's all this meditating? You know, I mean, I read, you know, the masters say we're already Buddhists, right? I mean, you know, what's the highest expression of Buddhahood? You know, when hungry I eat, when tired I sleep. Well, I can do that. I like that practice. You see? So we have to be careful, all right. But I think the essential thing is what you're saying is an important way to proceed, especially for somebody like you who's sort of beginning, is to really get it's already here. Okay, that's important. It's already here. The problem is I don't know it. You see, I can't experience it. That's not my experience. I don't experience myself as an enlightened being, totally open and spacious, free of self, totally interconnected with everything, right? That's not my experience. All right? So it's here. It is our original mind. It is your natural mind, right? It needs to be uncovered. And that's good to understand. It's not like I got to go somewhere, you know, geographical, or I got to go find this special teaching or this, you know, no, I got to, it's all right here. I have to do the work of, wherever I go, I'm going to have to do the same work. It's got to be uncovered. So that at least gives you a, you know, kind of, you know, it doesn't have you endlessly accumulating teachings and practices or endlessly looking outside yourself. You realize, oh, I just need, you know, the teachings and technology that help me uncover what's already here. I mean, does that make sense? I mean, and that kind of settles you down. Yeah. You know. And it gives you, and you know, when we say trust in mind, it means, oh, I trust, yeah, it's already here, right? It actually, you might find this hard to believe, it actually was the one who asked the question. That was your true mind. Don't think. See, you start to think. See, it doesn't have a name. We say it can't be known by the thinking mind. It is the thinking mind, the discriminating mind, that actually separates us from ourself. Right. Okay? Any other questions about going forward? Think about your life, what you're going back to, anything not clear, how to proceed. I mean, I realize all of you are involved in the community, we've got a lot going on, so, and many of you have been to retreats, and you know, so, but I just want to make sure. Brandy?
just really like just trying to notice my mind, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when something arises in my mind, it's about self,
mm-hmm.
right? Some attachment, some. I've just kind of been, aha, right? And then just kind of, I picture the seeds and kind of imbue the seed with patience and loving kindness and send it back down.
Mm-hmm.
And just like, just so that I'm not, I'm trying not to get judgy about myself.
Mm-hmm.
And just like, okay, it's good that that came up.
Just stop for a second, because you see what when you said that, what we don't realize is when we get judgmental and impatient, we are cultivating the judgmental, impatient, dissatisfied mind. You see, all that stuff that we think we're doing, we get angry at ourselves, impatient with ourselves, judgmental, all we're doing is generating more unwholesomeness, which is just feeding those, you know, it's just sending more down there. And we wonder, where does it all come from? You know, so so it's just perfect. Because even as we're going around today trying to practice, we're also practicing by cultivating the unwholesome mind. Not good. All right. So you are sitting. You are in awareness, mindful. Things come up. You see an unwholesome thought, right? And you pause. You stop. You see it. You name it, and you imbue it with the opposite, we might say. Yeah, we call that practicing with antidotes. Yeah, and that's a very good practice, because you are not, you're doing two things. You are changing by not acting on, you know, by holding that attachment or whatever it is in mindfulness, but as well as you are immediately connecting it to a wholesome, which you're sending back down. And again, that is in the Yogacara very much how we transform the seeds. Right? We have to cultivate wholesome and stop cultivating the unwholesome, because when you understand the Yogacara, you go, yeah, everything I think, feel, words I speak is leaving an impression. You know, and it doesn't matter if you're doing it in the privacy of your own house where nobody can see you. You know, it doesn't matter if you're in the bathroom stall where nobody can see you. If you are thinking unwholesome thoughts, it is leaving an impression in the mind. We have to kind of understand that this process is 24 hours a day. It's going on. I mean, that's, you know. And when we understand that, we kind of, you know, we become whole. Does that make, you know, we understand, yeah. You know, in all my waking time, I need to be cultivating this wholesome mind and not coding, but wholesome. There's no time off. Because oftentimes, you know, out in public or in certain situations, we're just cultivating wholesomeness, right? I mean, there's nobody more wholesome than me, right? But then we go home, and we, you know, in the privacy of our own, you know, we cultivate unwholesomeness. And we wonder why it's not changing, you know, our life and our mind is not changing the way we think. But you go, well, the mind doesn't have a mind of its own. It is the mind. And it is, remember we said, the storehouse consciousness is a storehouse. It will store any seeds you put into it. It doesn't judge. You put positive seeds, it'll take care of those. You put negative seeds in, it'll take care of those. It's a non-discriminating storehouse. Is that clear? So that's why we, you know, that's the whole idea behind being a gatekeeper, right? I mean, there's got to be somebody with some criteria who's deciding, you know, what am I storing in the storehouse? Okay? Does that answer? Thank you. So good. So this brings the formal part of the retreat to an end.